is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Cascading impacts that we see coming out of drought, heat waves, agricultural drought, are migration, food insecurity for everyone, and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases.
That's Danielle Quiguin, a climate scientist, on the dangers from climate change that world leaders are trying to ease. Details coming up. Also, protest leaders in Sudan say demonstrations will continue until military leaders reverse their course. And Egypt's president lifts the nationwide state of emergency. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africans voting today in local government elections with the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, under pressure to hold on to power in several cities and towns. It's racked by corruption. Many municipalities it governs are bankrupt, and independent local government monitors say its mayors and councillors are mostly failing to deliver basic services. But as Darren Taylor reports, this doesn't necessarily mean the party is going to be hammered at the polls today.
In 2016, the ANC lost key cities such as Johannesburg to smaller parties, most notably the Chief Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA. The DA ended up governing the metros by forming coalitions with other parties. In some cities, it was forced into cooperation with South Africa's third biggest political organization, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. Policies of the DA and the EFF couldn't be more different. So unsurprisingly, it didn't take long for the coalitions to collapse. To get back into the driver's seat in the cities it lost 5 years ago, the ANC simply gave leadership positions to EFF officials in exchange for EFF support.
The DA and the EFF seem to be tricking themselves to actually throw this one away, because the ANC is currently at its weakest and they don't seem to be taking advantage of the ANC.
Independent political analyst Teboho Kass says just when it seems the DA is gaining on the ANC, one of its white leaders steps up with a comment bordering on racism, casting a shadow over the good work South Africa's most multiracial party's done in the municipalities it runs. As for EFF leader Julius Malema, says Kass, he promises jobs, land, houses, and education, everything free for everyone, but presents no plan of how to actually achieve this.
I don't see any of the ANC opponents or rivals making extreme inroads. I still believe that the ANC could actually spring many surprises and actually even win majorities. It might actually even go against the grain. People are tired. We've seen the instability of coalition politics or coalition governments where we've...
DA leader John Steenhuisen agrees. That's why he says his party plans on storming to outright victory in municipalities across South Africa, including Johannesburg, Cape Town, Tshwane, and Nelson Mandela Bay.
I think we're going to surprise even our most vehement critics in the media in this election, and I think we're going to put in a good performance.
Kass says the DA is certainly a lot more organized than the ANC, but he's convinced that the ruling party's poor showing in 2016 was because of the bad and allegedly corrupt leadership of then-president Jacob Zuma. This time round, says Kass, the ANC's put an entirely different character on its election posters.
People won't be voting for the ANC per se. In most instances, they'll be voting for Cyril Ramaphosa. And in the previous election, it was more a repudiation or a rebuke of former President Zuma than it was a rebuke of the ANC.
Steenhuisen insists the DA is not worried about the so-called Ramaphosa factor. He asks voters to remember that even with Ramaphosa leading it, the ANC is still the party running almost all the country's failing municipalities.
Sewage is flowing down streets into rivers. People sit for days without electricity, even when there's no load shedding. They're without water. Businesses are closing down in those towns and moving away. That's the crisis of local government. It's those people who've been very, very receptive to our message of change and delivery.
But as Cass points out, it's one thing clapping hands and cheering when an opposition politician you've only ever seen on TV visits your town, but quite another to put a cross next to his or her face in a polling booth. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Reuters reports that Sudan's army chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has dismissed the country's public prosecutor. Burhan has relieved a number of officials, including diplomats, from their posts since an army takeover a week ago. Meanwhile, the spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association, Mohammed Yusuf al-Mustafa, says protesters will continue demonstrating until the military reverses its recent takeover and hands over power to a civilian government. The Sudanese Professional Association, which was in the forefront of the uprising that toppled Omar al-Bashir in 2019, is now leading the current protest movement. On Saturday, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Sudan's cities in one of the largest pro-democracy protests since last week's takeover. According to the Sudan's Doctors' Committee, three protesters were shot dead in Omdurman during Saturday's protests, bringing the tally to at least 12 dead and over 280 wounded since last Monday. Reuters also reports that the United Nations on Sunday urged Sudan's generals to reverse their takeover of the country. The takeover, which has been condemned by the international community, threatens to derail the country's transition to democracy. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says he's lifting the nationwide state of emergency law that extended police powers and curtailed constitutional rights such as freedom of speech and assembly. Human Rights Watch welcomed the move, but said the president should also free the many thousands of people jailed under this law. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
Well, as you know, the country has become more stabilized. Terrorism in North Sinai is now more controlled, as evidenced by Israeli decision to establish a gas pipeline in the same area where Daesh, ISIL, used to operate hit and run operations. In fact, the Middle East and North Africa in the last 2 or 3 years has recorded the largest regional improvement in terrorism rate. This is according to Global Terrorism Index 2020. Deaths in the MENA region have fallen by 87% since 2016. Another reason is there is a desire to be more attractive for Western investment, approval by the Americans and the EU, and also to overcome the criticism that Egypt got recently at the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva from over 30 nations over its human rights record. So Egypt just feels that this is a time where we have to make an action and export a different image of the country. And that's why they started National Strategy for Human Rights, ending the state of emergency, opening a new complex of prisons that is following the American style. And this is also in response to human rights organization criticism that traditional Egyptian jails are overcrowded and unsuitable for prison inmates. And so there is all this series of acts are part of this new strategy.
Human Rights Watch said the Egyptian government needs to end many other emergency law-like restrictions on civic participations, freedom of speech, and peaceful assembly. Human Rights Watch said The president should also free the many thousands of people jailed under those unjust laws. Are these legitimate demands by Human Rights Watch?
Of course, anyone who has been under pre-trial arrest for a long time, facing the freedom of expression charges, should be freed yesterday, not today. However, freedom of expression does not include promoting calls for killing or promoting anarchy, violence, disruption of order in an area full of instability. All peaceful gatherings require prior approval in any democracy by the Interior Ministry, stating the location, participation, duration, and this is also to protect the participants and the spectators in the area maybe who are not happy with that. So this is also need to be addressed, and I think the national strategy for human rights had been addressing some of those issues, but we still need to see this is applied.
In August 2015, President Sisi decreed Law Number 94 on Confronting Terrorism. It espouses a very wide definition of terrorism that includes virtually all forms of civil disobedience. The government has used this law extensively to crush peaceful dissent and prosecute critics before abusive terrorism courts. Could that law be used as an alternative to the emergency law?
That law was enacted when Islamists used unlicensed demonstrations to obstruct regular traffic and law and order. Some even attacked private properties and persons, and that led to an ugly pictures of the situation in Egypt exported to the outside world. And that's why it was enacted. Civil disobedience at that time was seen as disturbing peace and stability and causing anarchy in the name of freedom. Freedom to protest needs to follow existing laws with specific dates, hours, duration, participation, to protect also peaceful and non-peaceful protesters from people who may find what is happening is obstructing their normal economic life and peaceful walk.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Ethiopia's government said today that rebellious Tigrayan forces killed 100 youths in Kombolcha, one of two towns the rebel group said it captured over the weekend. The statement did not include details, and government spokesperson Legesse Tulu did not immediately answer phone calls seeking comment. Tigray's People Liberation Front, TPLF, spokesperson Getachew Reda also did not immediately respond to phone calls seeking comment. Tigrayan forces claim to have seized the strategic town of Dese in Ethiopia's Amhara region on Saturday. Thousands of ethnic Amharas have sought refuge there. Global pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions are just a fraction of what's needed to prevent catastrophic global warming. That's the warning from the United Nations as world leaders at the critical COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Britain, try to agree on further action. Henry Ridgewell looks at what is at stake.
At the 2015 Paris Climate Summit, world leaders pledged to restrict global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But those promises are not being matched with policies, according to the United Nations Emissions Gap Report, published Tuesday. It warns that new commitments to reduce emissions made in the run-up to the Glasgow summit, known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, will reduce greenhouse gases by just 7.5% by 2030 compared to previous pledges. Restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require emissions cuts of 55%. Petteri Tallas is the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization.
So far, we have heard lots of political support for enhanced ambition of mitigation, but the concrete pledges have still been missing. And at the moment, we are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees warming rather than 1.5 to 2 degrees.
So what does that mean for the planet and for humankind? Scientists say climate change is already increasing the frequency and intensity of heat waves. A recent report from Chatham House calculated that globally, heat-related mortality has increased by nearly 54% among the elderly since the turn of the century, reaching 296,000 deaths in 2018. Daniel Quiggin is a co-author of the report.
We expect around about 400 million people to be experiencing heat waves to the extent that they're no longer able to work outside.
Heat waves and droughts would have a big impact on global food security. Crop failures and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases, such as the locust plague in East Africa last year, would lead to soaring prices. Again, Daniel Quiggin.
Over the next 30 years, about 50% more food is going to be required due to more people being on the planet, but also expectations around eating more meat, particularly in countries like China and Southeast Asia and so on and so on. But at the same time, under our assessment, we anticipate yields, harvests, to decline by around about 30%.
Warmer temperatures lead to more intense tropical storms and flooding. Longer term, melting ice caps will lead to sea level rises, putting coastal cities at risk. Extreme weather fluctuations also mean more intense and more prolonged droughts. Scientists say richer nations must deliver on their 2015 promise to help poorer nations pay for combating climate change and deal with its impacts. Again, Daniel Quiggin.
The big cascading impacts that we see coming out of drought, heat waves, agricultural drought, are migration, food insecurity for everyone, and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases. So there's a vested interest for those wealthy countries to ensure that the climate finance, that $100 billion per year that's been pledged for some time since Paris and before, is actually delivered upon. And it's not being delivered upon at the moment.
As world leaders prepare for Glasgow, the stakes for our planet and for the human race are getting higher, the impacts close to irreversible. Can a new global agreement be reached to slash emissions well beyond current commitments? Summit host British Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave his assessment Monday.
I'm very worried because it might go wrong, and we might not get the agreements that we need, and it's touch and go. It's very, very difficult.
Scientists say the outcome of the Glasgow summit will likely affect each and every one of us on a warming planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As climate change causes more disruptions across Africa, some farmers and organizations are adopting measures they hope will minimize the impact. In Kenya, a group has invested in cold storage facilities to ensure that excess produce that would have otherwise become gas-producing waste is collected, stored, and distributed to those in need, including victims of drought. Brenda Mulinya reports from Nairobi.
Lilian Vihenda prepares afternoon porridge for her young children. The flour she uses has just been delivered by the staff at Food Bank in Kenya, a non-profit organization that helps feed the needy in this Nairobi neighborhood. In the current hard economic times in Kenya, Vihenda says these care packages help keep her children in school. She says that the money that she would have used to buy food that she now gets from the bank will pay for her children's school fees, which is a great help. But in addition to helping the poor by salvaging excess food from farms and markets, Food Bank in Kenya is taking steps to blunt the harmful impact of climate change. John Gadungu, who heads the nonprofit, says the recent acquisition of a cold storage facilities allows the food bank to store more food while reducing greenhouse emissions from the farms.
When food in the farms ends up in the landfills, you find that there is a lot of toxicity within the air, because what happens is that when they rot in the landfill, they produce methane, which is a worse product than carbon dioxide. And if we curb food wastage,
we can be able at least to reduce the amount of gas that is produced from at least 6 to 8%.
Implementing climate-sensitive advances will be key to helping Africa adapt and mitigate the effects of climate change, says Adaption Strategies analyst Winnie Hayemba.
Agricultural technologies that also ensure that you have reduced CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions and so on, which are all greenhouse gases, are really, really important. So we really are in need of these technologies and then also the capacity to be able to apply these technologies and so on.
But technology requires funding and that remains a challenge. Experts say the continent will need more than $300 billion over the next decade as it develops strategies that will help cushion it from the effects of climate change. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Nigeria loses thousands of doctors every year to Europe, North America, and the Middle East due to poor salaries, benefits, and working conditions. Nigerian health authorities are promising to improve compensation to stop the country's medical brain drain. But as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, it may not be enough.
We didn't have the materials we needed to work with. So you would see people die from preventable diseases.
Nigerian Dr. Chiemezie Ibe comments on the poor state of Nigeria's health system from his new base in Britain. He relocated in August to take a new job with Better Pay.
I left because I got frustrated in a place where I worked in an environment where for the first 4 months of my employment, I was owed. And in these 4 months, I had bills to pay, I had responsibilities to meet up to, I had to be at work every day.
Dr. Ibe is among the estimated 2,000 Nigerian doctors lost every year to better paying jobs abroad, according to the country's National Medical Association, or NMA. Britain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and the United States are the main destinations. The NMA says underfunding, frequent strikes, overpay, and unfavorable health policies are to blame for the medical brain drain. Nigerian optometrist Ifeanyi Ogenye says money is not the only reason that health professionals are leaving.
When medical practitioners, you know, agitate for better working environment, it doesn't only entail salary. Like, I want to practice in an environment where I have basically all diagnostic tools at my disposal.
Pay disputes between Nigerian authorities and medical unions often simmer and lead to strikes. The latest involves the National Association of Resident Doctors strike, which was suspended in early October, more than 2 months after it began. Nigeria's Medical Association says the migration of doctors is the reason for Nigeria's falling doctor-to-patient ratio. But some doctors like Blessing Akuba say they would rather stay in Nigeria.
I have had several opportunities to work abroad, but I still chose to strengthen my country and strengthen the health sector.
This month, Nigerian authorities promised to increase pay in a bid to retain physicians. But medical expert Ejike Oji says a broader approach is needed to ensure Nigerian doctors stay.
The healthcare system is so broken that we need a lot of resources and we need a lot of transparency and accountability to make use of even the little that we want to put in it.
For now, thousands of Nigerian health professionals will continue trying to get a job abroad. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.